From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2010 when the Greece Police Department brought in a veteran from the Rochester PD to lead that department. Todd Baxter took the top job in Greece after that department was rocked with multiple scandals. He knew that public trust had suffered, and he promised a diligent, scandal-free department with the highest levels of accountability. 4 years later, Baxter left Greece to become the executive director of the Veterans Outreach Center, and by all accounts, his leadership resurrected the public's confidence in Greece police. And now he's aiming for a new job. Baxter announced this weekend that he'll challenge Monroe County Sheriff Patrick O'Flynn. Baxter running as a Democrat, the incumbent as a Republican. And during his announcement, Baxter said, quote, "I believe there is a new need for vision. Organizations get stagnant and this community is suffering," end quote. And so what would he change? What would his vision be if he is the next sheriff of Monroe County? He's our guest for the hour. Todd Baxter, welcome back to Connections.
It's always great to be here. Thank you.
And I want to say to the community, this is important. We've reached out to Sheriff O'Flynn and he will have equal time, of course, on this program. We hope he can join us soon. It will be interesting in the months to come. We'll try to structure more conversations, perhaps with them together. I know you guys know each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you like Patrick O'Flynn?
I do. He's a great person. He's someone that I've called upon several times for things that we needed to get done, for instance, in town of Greece. Or we've worked collaboratively in the SWAT world, our SWAT team assisting our SWAT team on call-outs and things like that. So sure, there's a great mutual respect there. He's a good man.
Is he a good sheriff?
Well, that's a setup question. there's a lot more I think we could do with that sheriff's department. There's a lot of potential there, and the reason I'm making this huge, huge jump in a change of our lifestyle is because I think there's potentiality there that's not being met. And with that, you know, that takes vigor, that takes a new, fresh set of ideas, that takes someone sometimes from the outside to see things totally different. So I think there's a lot more work to be done. That's a huge organization. It's the largest if you combine all the bureaus together, law enforcement agency here in Monroe County, and I love those types of things. That's me. That take that and collaborate with other outside agencies to build new vision, to motivate the troops that are there now. There's a lot more work that can be done.
It wasn't necessarily a setup question, and I'll tell you why, by the way. I'll tell you why. I actually think, and I'll interject a little of my own personal view. I think it's important in politics, and Todd will tell you, this is not necessarily a political position, but it's important when people are running for office to be able to say, you know, this is not personal. You can like somebody, but not think that they're doing the best job at it. And that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, this is about mission, the mission of law enforcement, the mission of the jail, the mission of the other bureaus. This is about programs that I think are going to be better. This is about, at the end, you know, I think about saving lives. You know, this is about potentially saving more lives in our community that we can touch with such a large organization. And so it's not personal for Todd Baxter by any means. I got a lot of respect for that man. And it's just that I believe I can do much better by the taxpayer. And with that, at the end of the day in November, you know, the taxpayers will show which leader they want. But I'm quite comfortable with the process we're going to go through.
I mentioned you served 22 years in RPD, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then hired in Greece back in 2010. A lot's been made of that, but let's just kind of set the scene for the community again. You took that job at a time when... fair to say that you understood you really couldn't have a scandal. You had to set a different course, didn't you?
Yeah. So I took over a department plagued with scandal. Five people arrested, if you will. Three end up going to prison, including the chief of police. The town had been rocked, the butt of most jokes in Monroe County. And when we came under it, we were under a microscope. When I walked through the door, people were waiting for that thing to implode a little more, waiting for a mistake to occur. It was just a great, great challenge that any leader wants to face. You know, I went out there with that whole idea, does this leadership thing really work? You know, all the study and all the practice. The city, I was pretty comfortable with what I was doing, even though we're leading unique SWAT environments and things like that. We're leading the whole city on the overnight as I was the overnight watch commander. It was still pretty stable. Greece was very unstable, and I looked forward to that challenge of going out there.
And now you look back at those 4 years. You told me you weren't going to leave until you felt the job had essentially been done. I mean, the job of police work never ends.
Done, right?
But you were not going to leave until you felt comfortable that the culture had changed. Do you feel that way?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the cops were built back up. They were very well trained. We selected a whole bunch of new police officers coming to the agency. We made several promotions, built a leadership team. We got the community back on our side by building trust, getting out into the community, having one-on-one relationships with a lot of the public. Also, when we did something wrong, we stood up and said we did it wrong. You know, and we told the public that, and we adjusted what we had to adjust. And then taking politics out of the police department was another big thing. Keeping those two separated was very important. And those missions were accomplished. We built the place back up. It has a culture of good policing. It's a solid police department today. It's running forward, and it's right where everybody would expect the police department to be.
And now you're coming off some time with the Veterans Outreach Center, but you had a lot of decisions to make on if you wanted to do to get into this race. You had thought about your family. You had to think about your health. You had a diagnosis in the last year on prostate cancer. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you feel good now?
Feel great. You know, the doctor did his surgery the day before Thanksgiving. And 3 months later, I go back for my follow-up exam, and the doctor says I'm cancer-free. That was incredible. That was something we weren't expecting as a family. And yeah, that was just a blessing.
All right. So that diagnosis, if you were still struggling with that, you think you would have made this jump?
Oh, heck no. No. Okay. You know, we were contemplating it. You know, we were talking about it. It's been talk around the coffee table for a long, long time. But, you know, that's a burden on the family that you just can't take a lot of risk. The way Mary and I looked at it, you know, we got that clean bill of health. Why did we get such a clean bill of health? So many of our friends suffering from the same cancer are not having the same results that we had. So it gave us a little more boldness. You know, can we go do something different with our life? And why not? We've been given this gift of health.
It was interesting on Saturday to see you on stage with a bunch of Democrats. And I only say that because until Friday, you were a Republican, even though you have said in the past you don't consider yourself all that political, that values can kind of cross party lines.
Absolutely.
But here you were next to Joe Morelli and Bill Maley and Harry Brunson. Was that strange for you?
No. You know, over the last few years, especially at the VOC, I've built a relationship with these people. As chief of police, you know, the supervisor in town of Brighton and I became friends. We crossed paths at different events. So a lot of these guys I got to know as a chief of police, but in particular, the nonpartisan work I did at the Veterans Outreach Center, you know, taking care of veterans, seeking funding for the Veterans Outreach Center, seeking better programs and new laws to support veterans, those go across party lines. I was meeting with both parties all the time, and I developed a relationship with some of those people that you've seen on the stage with me that turned into a word called trust, you know, and I started to trust them, they started to trust me, and it wasn't because of our political philosophies, it was more because we got to know each other over work, and I'm quite comfortable standing on the stage with those people, you know, those became people that I put a lot of trust in. Me and Mary and the boys are taking a big step here, you know, I'm putting a lot of trust, but vice versa, they're putting a lot of trust in Todd Baxter too, and I think we have that.
All right, listeners, you want to call the program as we talk to Todd Baxter about his run for Monroe County Sheriff. You can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Bill Maley said, forget party. He thinks Todd Baxter is a great cop and a great leader. And that's what we heard from a lot of the Democrats who were there, that for them, this isn't all that political a job. You feel like, sure, You got to run on a party line, but it's not that political position, Todd?
Well, you initially have to go through the process, and the process is set up by other people, not me, right? And the process is to go through the political campaigning process, and that's what we're doing right now. But even in those conversations, I've had some great, frank conversations with people that are very progressive. And when they want to sit down and have a cup of coffee, I'm more than willing to do that. And at the end of the day, we're not going to convince each other that our perspective on life is the right way, you know, but that's America. And you nailed it. When we start making some of these positions very ultra political, you know, like sheriff and district
judges.
Attorney and judges, yeah, we're in a, you know, that's not what we're set up to do. So I'm very passionate about that I'm still going to have Todd Baxter values. I am who I am. I'm not going to be sitting here making decisions based on I'm a Democrat now. I'm not going to make decisions based on if I was a Republican. You can't do that as sheriff. I'm a law enforcement officer, and we're looking for justice. And we're looking to help people, and we're looking to serve people. And those cross party lines, and we all know that.
All right, so the last party question I have for you is this. Did they come to you, or did you go to them? Because we know that the incumbent is a Republican, and he was running for re-election. But did the Democrats say, Todd, we've been getting beat up in county politics. We always lose. We want to win. You can win. Come run with us. Or did you reach out to them and say, look, do we have a common goal here? This is a position I'd want.
You know, it was literally some coffee talk. You know, we're talking about veterans, and I'm meeting with the political figures, again, as I'm supposed to do at the VOC, meet with these folks and encourage them to support veterans. And it came up in conversation, like, hey, I understand you might be running for sheriff. The rumor's going rampant, and it's been going rampant for years.
Yes, it has.
Yeah, nonstop.
Yes.
So, you know, with that, I remember that one conversation. I said, well, are you being serious about this potential thing? You keep on asking me about it. And they said, well, are you seriously thinking about running? And that was pretty how the conversation.
How long ago was that?
That was just a few months ago, you know. And once we found out that there's some potential here, you know, I started exploring a little further with the Democratic Party and the Democratic leadership. Look at what's it mean you would support me? What's it mean that you would have my back? What's it mean that you'll take care of, you know, me getting on a ballot and all these things that need to occur? Because if I have to do this, I have to give up everything. I have to give up the Veterans Outreach Center. There's laws about me doing both jobs at the same time. Plus, you don't want to make veterans political. So I knew if I was going to make the step, I'd have to risk all and maybe go unemployed for the next 9 months. And so those conversations started like that, and I got that confidence that they would support me on my bid.
Has Bill Rylick called you?
Yes. Yeah, we had a conversation.
Is he a big fan of this move or what? I mean, he's got to be a little—
No, but again—
He had to kind of know it was coming, but—
Yeah, I mean, the rumors have been floating around for years, right? And I worked for Mr. Rylick, and we had a conversation, and we'll leave it at that. I don't want to share our conversations, but, you know, he wasn't antagonistic about it. I'm sure there's going to be some things in the next few months that he has to do as being the chairman of the Republican Party, and he needs to win, and there'll be that natural battle that occurs there. But it wasn't antagonistic or anything like that. It was just let's get together and let's talk about this, and that was it. And I really appreciate those conversations. That's the way we should work. You know, this shouldn't be you're a jerk or you're a bad person. Everybody has their own perspective in life. Everybody has their own job. Everybody has different goals and wants. I keep on going, this is America. This is what our Constitution set up to do. And why is it got to be personal all the time? Why can't it just be professional? Let two guys go at it and let the voters in November choose who they want to be that leader.
Todd Baxter is running for Monroe County Sheriff. He is challenging the incumbent, Patrick O'Flynn. And we're going to hope to talk to the sheriff very soon on this program. Certainly there'll be equal time, and hope to have multiple conversations as we get ready for that election later this year. So you mentioned the jail. You mentioned Monroe County Jail, and I think let's start here. Let's get as specific as we can. When you look at the jail and you've got concerns about what's been going on in this community and what you would do different, start there. Tell me what is going through your mind there.
Well, we all visualize this revolving door of these young men and women that have head trauma in their life. They're placed in bad positions and they end up doing criminal activity. Why? That's a whole social study right there, right? That's each one of these crimes is a microcosm of our society. Not much we can do about that, getting in the middle of it. Law enforcement does their best, you know, and they keep trying new innovative ideas. But the common denominator of most of this violence and most of this disruption that's occurring in our community would be that most of these people end up in a Monroe County jail. You know, whether they're victims or suspects in criminal activity in the future, most of them have been incarcerated, and we know that. It's called the revolving door. So what have we done, or what are we going to do to stop that flow, stop that revolving door? You know, and it takes a whole paradigm change. That takes a whole philosophy of change. You know, we're doing wonderful things. We're incarcerating. You got good deputies in there protecting the inmates, protecting herself on the overnight shift. You got programs in there. You got pastors going in there. You got different work. But in the last 30, 40 years, what has really changed to the point that we're accepting as norm of 200 people being shot in our community a year? We don't even talk about it anymore. 40 additional people being murdered a year. We don't even talk about that. If it's a little low, we applaud ourselves. If it's a little higher, we say we got to do more programs. That's not Todd Baxter. Todd Baxter, take these things and let's see if we got a common place that we can work. And then where do we get our collaborative partners in there? There's social service agencies. There's nonprofits out there willing to do work to take care of our incarcerated folks when they leave the jail. And it could be that progressive step out. It doesn't have to be just go out. It could be go out and you already have a job. It could be go out and you already have stable housing. It could go out and we have a case manager tracking you with your probation officer or whatever it's going to be. And we're held accountable. We're measuring those things. Each person leaving is an individual. Are we measuring how we're successful with those people? Or is it just that whole rate we keep on talking about while they're back in jail? I think we could do a lot more, and that's my vision. I'm a visionary type person, and look at the work we did at the VOC when we brought 40 nonprofits, 40 government agencies, 40 local and federal agencies together in one central figure, and now we take care of veterans as humans, individuals, but we case manage them through 40 different agencies if that's what it takes to take care of that veteran, get them back on their feet.
All right, so I confess this is the first time I've heard someone who's either the sheriff or running for sheriff talking about recidivism rates and what can be done in the jail to change that. And maybe I just haven't been listening well enough. I don't know. And we'll talk to the sheriff for his thoughts on this and perhaps for his rebuttal on this. I don't think you can argue that recidivism rates are high and that Todd is speaking from experience, that you see people who are there and unfortunately they are rearrested in the future quite often. But what you're talking about is a lot of different agencies that provide services. Are we talking about any new funding, anything new, or are you just taking what's existing and bringing them together?
Well, you can have a little bit of both. Again, who wants to put another burden upon the taxpayers? And what I learned in the last 3 years is just the breadth of wonderful social service agencies out there and the breadth of nonprofits out there willing to do a lot of the work. But yet we find sometimes egos. We find silos because I want to keep my statistics. I don't want you to get into my territory. You know, we have to break down those egos and break down, and that takes leadership to get people in the same room and say, what is our end result? What are we trying to do? And with that, if you have a part of that, how are you going to fit it? But I don't want your statistics. I don't want your numbers. I don't want your budget, right? We got plenty of work to do in the sheriff's department, but we're seeing the same kids over and over. What is the stepping stone process when they get into the jail and when they leave the jail? And how are we breaking down that whole cycle? It's not that difficult to do when you get people together and you build that trust with them and say, look, you do housing really, really well. You do stable housing for people that are addicted. You do stable housing for people that are in trauma. What are we doing when we have people leave the jail? Can we give them some additional stable housing that we got them in a safe environment? You do drug and alcohol counseling, phenomenal. You do mental health counseling, phenomenal. Have we built the coalitions now and built a network so we're tracking each other? It's not just I sent the guy over there and I forgot about him and what happened to him, I have no idea. No, we need to know what happened to him 6 months from now, what happened to him 9 months from now. That's no additional burden on the taxpayers for Monroe County. You could do that. Those service providers are already there. And then if you need additional funding, think about the money coming into Rochester right now under the Upstate Revitalization Initiative. Talks about anti-poverty. Who in the jail is probably not in poverty, right? And so if you want anti-poverty, you know, leveraging those resources, going before the Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council and leveraging those resources to help get those folks. And let's talk about this as a poverty issue too, these people that are incarcerated.
Sorry, so two kind of short follow-ups then. When we talk about people who are incarcerated, you're talking about resources for them once they are released. You're talking about housing, whatever, sometimes mental health counseling, sometimes job training. Mm-hmm. What about when they are incarcerated? Is there a concern that they're not being treated like future citizens of society, that they're treated like criminals? Is that too soft an approach? You know, some people say yes. You know, how do you feel about the process when they are incarcerated?
Well, that's a twofold answer. And first of all, you know, people are incarcerated because a judge sentenced them to jail, right? And they committed a crime and they did some kind of disruption in our community. With that, I would like to see these folks doing a little bit more work for their communities. You know, we see these work details out on 390 on the weekends and picking up trash. When was the last time you seen a work detail on Clinton Avenue? You know, when's the last time you've seen a work detail on Genesee Street? Or even one of the suburbs that if a community wants prisoners to come out there and clean up their park and we can work with the local law enforcement. There's a lot of effort for people to give back to society while they're sitting incarcerated to do more work. And work's a beautiful thing. You know, people
work,
you know,
is dignity.
Yeah, work is dignity. And you get that appreciation. Plus, you get that work ethic. May not have had it before you went in jail, but, you know, you gain some work. And you gain relationships. You know, I've worked in this community before. I've worked with these people before. It's not this whole transition thing. It's like a black and white. I'm in jail now. I'm out of jail. There's a lot of work to be done there. But then on the other side of that, while you're in jail, what is the rehab going on there? You know, we got people, for example, walking in jail. They're arrested for criminal possession of controlled substance 7th. They have a couple bags of heroin in their pocket. We know they're heroin addicts, right? Yet we're throwing these people right in general population when they're at the lowest low of their life. They've been in the backseat of a police car. Now they're sitting in pre-arraignment waiting to go to jail. You know, are we doing all we can for those people when they're in the lowest low to help them break that cycle of addiction? And then what are we doing from an addiction standpoint, breaking that cycle to the recovery? Recovery is a very important part. A lot of people can break the addiction. It's the long-term recovery. There's wonderful agencies out here, again, doing recovery very well. Is there a collaboration that's continuing on, not only in the jail in the recovery, but out of the jail? So again, we don't see them again.
You brought up heroin, and mm-hmm. in this community, in any community, there's sort of drug trends that happen over years and sort of cycles that happen. Have you seen anything quite like heroin that we're seeing?
No, not at all. I police the streets of the city of Rochester when crack was the epidemic. Mm-hmm. And we had lots of violence. We had lots of drug sales. We had lots of drug dealers, a lot of drug abusers. I could tell you right now, heroin is not even comparable. It's off the charts. It's beyond. It's more scary. From the standpoint, it's in every demographics. Crack was inner city Rochester, you know, inner city urban areas, these particular neighborhoods. We knew where it was. We knew the drug dealers. Heroin, you know, I was a part-time police officer in Ogden. A beautiful mom of a couple kids passed away from a heroin overdose in a suburb like Ogden. You know, it's every demographic. It's every suburb. It's every urban area. It's in schools. It's in work environments. It's incredible. It's out of control, pandemic type stuff here.
Is there a role for the sheriff to do more with that, Ted?
There always is. You know, you look at the sheriff's department, that should be the lead law enforcement agency in the county. Not from the standpoint of doing everybody else's job. We have great local police departments. We've got a great city police department. But more of the coordination, the collaboration, getting people together, sitting down in a room and going, this is a serious community concern. This is not only, you know, a criminal problem, but this is also a health problem in our community. What are we doing? Who's that central figure pulling all these elements together? Not just programs. You know, we come up with these programs. Well, we're going to throw a program together for that. What is the collaborative effort here? And you got to look at it almost like a military operation. Like, what's our end goal? Our end goal is, can we save this many kids, or can we stop this much drug dealing in this area, or can we slow down the number of incarcerations related to drug? And then what is our plan, our collaborative plan to go at that? You need that central figure in a community to pull all those resources and all those people together to go at it with a much more wide breadth. But what I can tell you is it makes crack cocaine almost look like a walk in the park. I mean, I don't say that lightly. A lot of people got hurt. A lot of people lost their lives. The people losing their lives to heroin right now is utterly incredible, and I think most of the community doesn't realize it.
Now, would the sheriff say, look, well, I don't know what Todd's been saying, but we are trying to attack
this? Yeah. And I'm sure they are. You know, and again, there's great programs out there. And the fact is, it's not the lack of effort by the deputies on the road. It's not a lack of effort from the deputies inside the jail that are working with the people that are addicted. It's not a lack of programs. Again, where Todd Baxter comes from, is this vision of, all right, those programs are putting a stopgap measure in it. You know, they're slowing things down. It's a Band-Aid approach. But taking it again, what is the holistic approach here? You know, and I look at the education. So we need to be out there pounding the education. Not only in the schools, that's great, but there's adults dying from this. Where's their education? Then I look at engineering. What I mean by engineering is, do we engineer groups? Do we engineer programs? Do we engineer money and resources and put that together in an engineering model that, yeah, we got a program now that's holistic and moving forward? And then the third part is always enforcement. You know, we're a law enforcement agency. So the people selling the dope, we need to go after them. The people selling the dope that kill other people, just like they did in Gates, I thought that was a phenomenal move. We're going to go after them for murder charges if we can, or homicide charges. We're going to make a statement. If you keep on selling people dope and it's killing people, you're going to go to jail as long as you can. You know, so if you look at it, education, more breadth of education. It needs to be on billboards. It needs to be on our evening news. It needs to be everywhere. Engineering great resources that we have in the community to come together collaboratively to solve this problem. And then, of course, the enforcement end.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. And this is from Linda in Henrietta. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, thank you. I'm just coming in on your program, and I appreciate you taking my call. I don't have anything to refute anything you said. I'm just sort of corroborating. I have a son who was incarcerated for 19 months, got out in December, and he was incarcerated for crimes related to his heroin addiction. Hmm. And two comments. One is that while he was incarcerated, he was offered the choice to go to an internal drug program there. But if you do that, then you have to live in the drug treatment dorm, and that's where all the drugs are. So he was very serious about his sobriety, and so he chose not to avail himself of that program simply because it was just legendary where he was, that's where the Suboxone is, that's where the drugs are, that's where it's being smuggled. And so he actually kept straight by not being part of that program. And when it was time for his parole board hearing, when he was released, they said, it says here that you wouldn't take drug treatment. Why is that? And he said, because I didn't want to use drugs anymore. And doing the drug treatment program there was tantamount to saying, let me get in the loop of where all that stuff is. I was able to keep sober by not doing that. And the second comment is about the services afterwards. It's true. He was released to a Salvation Army shelter. That happened to him before, too, where basically you walk in the door and immediately somebody offers you a needle. The services for when people are released, as everybody knows, are pretty dismal. And if you have time, anybody who's listening, to look online at a place called Second Wind in Ithaca, there's a gentleman who actually gave his land, took donations, and built cottages for people coming out of prisons, coming out of treatment programs. So to get their feet on the ground and be able to apply for jobs, they'd have a hot shower, they'd have a sober place to live. It wouldn't be just kind of parking them in a shelter somewhere. It's pretty rough when you get out, even with the best of intentions, when you don't have money, when you don't have a place to be that feels safe, to really try to stay the course if you've been able to put it together and put some sobriety together in prison. Anyway, I'm a little long-winded. Those are my comments, and thank you for taking my call.
Linda, wow. Thank you for the phone call. Go ahead, Todd.
How about that passion? And I can only imagine. Couldn't really put myself in her shoes, but I can only imagine. And we see so many of these, folks that are addicted. These are good people, most of them. You know, they get again, getting addicted to heroin is totally different than getting addicted to crack cocaine. This is the whole process with the painkillers, or, you know, and it's been utterly incredible. Watch this explosion occur over the last few years. But she was hitting on the recovery. You know, we spend a lot of time on the enforcement. We spend a lot of time on the addiction and the withdrawals and the medicines we can give them through the withdrawals. And then what do we do for the next 3, 4, 5 years? You know, that's the recovery process. And it's got to be continuous. And sobriety is one thing. Support's another thing. Engaging your mind with other things besides your addiction. You know, that work, if we talked about earlier. Those are huge parts of it, you know, and people are going to say, well, what's the sheriff's department have to do with all that? I think it has a lot to do with it. You know, we're arresting these people, right? We're incarcerating them, and tax dollars at an extreme amount, $105 a day to incarcerate them is just one reason for everybody to get motivated about it. Let's stop paying all that money to incarcerate someone that has an addiction.
You mentioned the deputies doing the work, and certainly this is not about criticizing deputies at all. You know, people in law enforcement in this community probably better than most of all of us, Todd. Mm-hmm. How do you think the morale is under Sheriff O'Flynn?
Yeah, again, my interaction with deputies, my interaction with folks that know deputies, it's pretty much across the board. There's a morale issue, if you will. There's a lack of feeling like they're respected. And I don't take that lightly. I love cops. I love deputies. I love people that are willing to do that job. You know, it's a volunteer job. It's a great career. But at the end of the day, you got to be a special person to go in someone's backyard at 3 o'clock in the morning and clear that backyard of a potential prowler and know that might be the last move you make in the rest of your life. That takes a very special person to pull over car after car after car looking for a DWI arrest, and you don't know which one's going to have a gun sticking in your face when you walk up to that. That takes a very special person. Someone to sit in that jail and work with inmates all day long, that's a very difficult environment, you know. So the first thing we should do is just hold those guys and gals up with a whole lot of esteem, a whole lot of respect. You got to honor those people. And that's a leadership trait that I've always had across the board, you know. I believe if you take care of your troops, they're going to take care of most of all that stuff for you. They'll take care of the constituent. Even when they're frustrated at 3 o'clock in the morning, they'll take care of the constituent because they know they're being appreciated. It's not always a money issue either. You know, sometimes it's just that I care. I'm out here with you. I'm walking your beat with you. I'm in the jail. I'm walking the floors with you. Sometimes that's just leadership right there. Let them know. So again, that's just my leadership philosophy. That's my style. I take it to heart when troops aren't happy. But on the other side, we know we're not going to make everybody happy. Sometimes you got to be the boss, and sometimes you got to hold your foot down, and sometimes you got to discipline. I'm not afraid of that either. You know, that has to occur. But that occurs so little. You know, when you get hire good people, you train good people, and you hold them accountable for their actions, they usually knock it out of the ballpark more often than not for you.
Now, if what you're saying is true, if morale is an issue and under Patrick O'Flynn, why do you think that is? Why do you think it's not as strong as it could be?
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of speculation with contracts, and contracts are an ebb and flow. Sometimes you get a good contract, sometimes you get a bad contract. They just got a terrible contract. The road cost this mass exodus of almost 40 employees. That hurts. That hurts morale when you get a bad contract, especially when you're doing a job that you put so much into, including potentially your life, right? That hurts on the inside. But again, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you can do besides paychecks that makes people happy at work. And you know that. You worked for environments that you'd probably do for free. You're like, this is a great place to be, and everybody's just friendly and everybody's happy. And I feel like I'm accomplishing something. I'm really doing something for someone else. I'm serving. I think morale is also local. You know, you spend a lot of time in empowering your sergeants and your lieutenants. Let them take care of morale. As a leader, are you empowering them to take care of them? Are you giving them flexibility in their scheduling? Are you giving them flexibility to do details? Are you giving them flexibility, maybe even overtime, to backfill where there's shortages? We spend a lot of overtime in police departments. You know, there's crime patterns, and you have to address with overtime and stuff like that. Do you take this down to the lowest common denominator and give that to the first-line supervisors to dictate how they're going to spend money in their local section to solve local problems? It's not this top building way downtown in the middle of the city of Rochester. There's a lot of things you could do about morale.
Okay. And you know, fairly or not, in recent years, the sheriff's gotten a lot of attention for advocating for himself for a pay raise. Has that bothered you at all?
Yeah, and I don't know all the workings of that. I haven't been in any of those meetings. I'd be remiss to say the sheriff said this, the sheriff did that.
Okay.
What I do know is the sheriff got a nice pay raise, and some of the troops didn't. And I can understand how that can cause some grievance in your employees. But you know, the nuances of that, I'd be remiss to say and come out and fire a shot. That's, you know, Todd Baxter would have a heart. I would definitely be talking about that with the troops and saying, you know what, I know what this looks like. This is what it is. And you got to have those conversations with your people. And that's got to be a face-to-face conversation. It can't be an email. It can't be a PowerPoint.
So at the very least, if you're going to advocate for it, understand how that might be perceived in the rank and file.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's called emotional intelligence, right? You understand what your people are thinking or understand what the community is thinking, and you get out there and you communicate with them. Again, I don't know that I wasn't part of contract negotiations, and I wasn't part of the pay raise negotiation, but I know that people are hurting from that.
Todd Baxter is running for Monroe County Sheriff. We're going to get our only break of the hour. John, we'll come back, get your phone calls, and there's a few lines open if you want to call with questions or comments. 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI for calling from Rochester. 263-9994. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Steve Curwood, the host of NPR's Living on Earth, joins us. He's in Rochester talking about what environmental resiliency means and green jobs for our city. Steve Curwood, first hour. And then we're talking to soon-to-be college graduates. How does the job market really look? Can they stay in Western New York? It's the first in our series of conversations. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. John in Rochester next on the phones. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Todd. Todd, what's your thinking? If you become sheriff, are you going to have any pushback to Governor Cuomo and Eric Schneiderman on their lawless policies on sanctuary-type cities and municipalities? And the second part of my question is, do you support the death penalty?
The first one, well, there's a lot of talk about sanctuary cities, and the confusion is simply amazing. You know, it's a hotbed political item. And then you ask law enforcement to, in the middle of the night, make a decision when the laws aren't clear. You have a sanctuary city. You don't have a sanctuary county. You might have some towns with some sanctuary policies. And you got a multi-jurisdictional organization like a sheriff's department wondering what day of the week it is and, you know, what the policy and procedure. What I would ask of the legislation is, look, the legislators should make laws, and they should make clear laws, and then that should be part of the law enforcement element to take care of those laws. We're not seeing that right now. There's a lot of confusion. There's more politics and grandstanding than there is this is what we want as a society, and it's totally confusing for law enforcement to even think about how do we enforce these and not enforce them. What do I do when I get someone pulled over at 3 o'clock in the morning or someone walks into the jail? The other thing on that is I just don't want deputies going around and being proactive. And I was a cop for 30 years. I can't remember too many times we're proactively looking for someone's immigration papers or, you know, asking them what your status is in America. You just don't do that usually as a law enforcement officer. You know, usually you're investigating a crime or someone's a victim of a crime and you're investigating a specific thing. So,
well, do you think they should change their policy to help the federal government out on this huge problem of lawless, illegal immigrants?
Well, I wish they would just give me clear law, you know. And
so you'd support it if they didn't make that change.
Well, if they had clear law, we're law enforcement agencies, we'd have to support the law, right? So that's what law enforcement agencies do. I don't think local law enforcement should go around and do federal jobs. They don't do the DEA's job. They don't do the FBI's job. They assist those people when they call. And vice versa. Sometimes we might end up with someone that we need the assistance of the FBI or the DEA, and local law enforcement then calls upon them. But it's not where we want to go out and do enforcement of immigration law.
As a voter, I'd like to see cooperation on that issue and other criminal issues.
Absolutely. You know, and that's the name of the game. I mean, we have people that do their job very good. They have specificity in certain elements. And that's why you have local law enforcement, that they're not out doing the FBI's job and the DEA's job, but they use them as a tool sometimes and vice versa. You know, they call us, we call them.
Exactly.
But we don't want them looking, you know.
So it makes sense to cooperate with the feds on this issue, I think. On the death penalty, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I'm a believer in the death penalty from the standpoint that I think certain crimes, and we can go over the deterrent argument all day long. I also sometimes look at it as justice, and I do know one case that I believe it would have been a deterrent. I helped with the manhunt for Ralph Bucky Phillips, and the intelligence there told us that he had already shot a cop. He knew he was going back to prison for life, and he was willing to shoot more cops. And two more troopers, unfortunately, were ambushed, and one of them lost their life. So may that have deterred Ralph if he knew he was facing the death penalty? I don't know, but I know his statements prior to that kind of led us to believe that he had nothing to lose. He was going to go back to prison for life anyways. He already shot one trooper. The other side of that is some crimes in Todd Baxter's world are so heinous that I believe that that's the punishment that would be just for it. And I know not everybody agrees and everybody disagrees, but that's okay. This is America. Again, what are the laws saying about that? And then we'll uphold and follow the law.
I also want to just clarify as best I can, and I'm not the expert on sanctuary cities and counties, but most of the time when you've seen sanctuary cities or sanctuary counties making such declarations, it comes from a legislature that's passing a resolution of some kind, not necessarily from a sheriff's department or law enforcement. Law enforcement is sort of carrying out what they're told to
do. Yeah, and that's the difficult part. We don't, and not the difficult part, that's the way the Constitution is set up. We don't make the laws. You know, whether we like the laws or not, there's been many times I've been on a protest line, and one side of the protest is something I believe in, the other side of the protest, but a law enforcement officer doesn't stand there and go, I like these people more. And the law enforcement stands the line, toes the line, and makes sure no one gets hurt in that situation. We don't like all the laws, but we enforce the laws.
All right, back to the phones, and Susan in Rochester next. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling as a parent and a voter. My kids are all trained in what to do if a gunman comes to the school. You know, the hide, run, fight training that they get now. And there was a recent article in The Guardian about the rise of so-called sovereign citizens, people who are, you know, armed and dangerous and don't believe in law enforcement or the government. And I just wondered, recognizing that this is kind of the most difficult type of criminal or crime to prevent, but what do you see the role of the sheriff's office being in dealing with this rise of I guess, lone wolf gunmen, and how do you see the sheriff's office keeping us safe from them?
Thank you, Susan. I think it's such an interesting question because, as she points out, how do you stop a lone wolf attack? I mean, it's I don't know if anybody has a perfect answer for it, but what do you say to Susan?
First of all, identification ahead of time, prevention is a great thing. You could do that two-prong. One, knowing your students better. You know, having more interaction, identifying students, getting people to come forward when they realize their friend in 10th grade is having a real social issue and made some threats, and they're willing to come through the school administrators with that information or even call local law enforcement. That comes from, again, from that education standpoint we talked about. How do we educate people to look for those signs, those early warnings? There's a lot of common traits when you study these active shooters that are not terrorist related. There's a lot of common traits. You can see the early warning signs. And most often when you're Monday morning quarterback, you look at it from hindsight, you said, yeah, those two, three signs came up and no one put the pieces of the puzzle together. That's kind of like the JTTF does with local terrorism threats. You know, they're looking for different pieces of the puzzle and then they're trying to put that puzzle together, and then they react to it if there's enough pieces of the puzzle, and they either do an intervention or they do an investigation. Same thing with, you know, getting our schools and educating our kids more often on the social abnormalities that are occurring in these kids' lives. Have they been bullied? Is there a big target that was put on their back? Is there was a big moment? And then the other side is, as she mentioned, which I believe 100% in, is teaching people how to react. The run, hide, fight model is a great model. When I was in the chief in Greece, we trained every town agency, librarians, DPW, any employee that wanted to come, we taught them how to react to an active shooter. You know, one of the things we talk about is lockdowns. You know, lock the school down or lock the building down. Well, most public buildings don't have locked doors on the inside. By fire code, they can't lock the door. So how are you going to lock? You need to get in those environments in a non-hot environment, non-threatening environment, and walk through. Law enforcement could do that. I believe the sheriff's department should and has done some good stuff of teaching people about active shooter response. And then the last thing is breaking down the whole denial thing. You know, she mentioned it. It could happen anywhere. Where was Columbine on everybody's roadmap before Columbine? Right now, it's a name that none of them can forget. It doesn't mean it can't happen in any jurisdiction around here. So are we proactively talking about this, not in denial? And are we just not being paranoid, just be prepared? You know, we prepared years ago for fires in our schools, and when's the last time you heard a kid get burned in a school fire? Same thing. These active shooters are just as relevant. We need to be training that. Physical security in the school is a big thing, you know, locking doors.
All right, Roger in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Roger.
I had two questions, but I'm going to someone already pretty much asked the other question. Your guest there, Todd Baxter, mentioned a moment ago about, I think you said Ducky Phillips?
Bucky Phillips, yeah.
Bucky Phillips, okay. And based on his actions, that he should have, or he agreed with the death penalty in that regard. And I was curious to hear your, Mr. Baxter's comment on police officers, such as the one in Dallas, Texas, who recently shot a 15-year-old, they ended up changing their story on what initially happened. Now, if in fact this police, well, he's already been fired, but if in fact this police officer is convicted and found guilty, does he agree with the death penalty for this police officer who fatally killed a 15-year-old?
Roger, stay there. Go ahead, Todd.
Yeah, so, you know, death penalties, I'm thinking of a premeditated, planned execution of someone where, you know, Ralph Bucky Phillips had the mindset that I'm going to shoot a cop and then I'm going to shoot two more cops or however many cops I can get away with. You know, that's premeditated. That's kind of where I'm going with that, where someone sets up, you know, I don't know all the facts of the case that you're talking about in Dallas. You know, was it an intentional homicide or was it a reckless thing or was the officer justified? I just don't know enough to comment specifically on that one. But trying to answer your question, you know, when I'm thinking of death penalty, I'm thinking of someone that goes out and intentionally takes other people's lives with such gravity that the only justice it could possibly be, or the deterrence factor of it. Again, going back to Ralph Bucky Phillips making the statement that I shot one, I could shoot more. I'm only going to get life in prison.
Okay, so in the New York State as it stands right now, if an individual shoots a cop, whether it's premeditated or if it's by accident, does that individual receive the death penalty, or does he receive life in prison?
No, he does not automatically receive the death penalty, but almost every case that I can think of has been a life in prison or some other type of punishment.
So I'll go back to my original question. Even if it's not found that a law enforcement officer kills an unarmed individual regardless of their race or their gender, if it was not premeditated, but they are found guilty by a jury,
yep,
that what they did was against procedure, and that person, that American citizen, dies, are you equally in favor of the death penalty for a law enforcement officer who takes the life of an American citizen unlawfully?
Now, maybe I can have a little dialogue here with you, because I think we're saying two different things, right? We have one that's premeditated. Someone goes out and says, I'm going to go kill these people, and then executes those people.
Right.
They got the other one that's part of a job. He's going out, he made a mistake or even totally messed it up. But it's not premeditated. He's not going out and saying, let me kill someone today. That's the big difference that draws the line in my mind, why one would be a death penalty case for me and one would not be a death penalty case.
Okay, but would you be in favor of a law enforcement officer convicted of killing, whether premeditated or not?
No, he's saying no. Roger.
That's not my... Yeah,
okay,
not
go ahead.
Premeditated, but if he takes... Would you be in favor of that law enforcement officer being sent to prison?
Being sent to prison.
Yeah, if he's convicted of crime, of homicide. You know, there was a case down in South Carolina not too long ago that, you know, the officer basically, you know, was shooting someone in the back as he was running away,
yes,
right?
So, exactly.
You know, the...
And he was...
That's up to the
hung jury.
That's up to the...
Got away with that.
Right. That's up to, you know... Again, premeditated, I hope I'm making my point clear. You know, premeditated says, I'm trying to think of another example, but I'm going to go in this school and I'm going to intentionally kill as many kids in this school as I can before the cops get here and the guy surrenders or he's taken into custody. That is a premeditated murder of 20, 30 people. I think the death penalty is just in that situation.
Well, I guess my point is that I'm not so much hung up on the death penalty,
yep,
or whether it's death penalty or if it's imprisonment. My focus, I guess, is that law enforcement officers who have been involved in taking the lives of unarmed individuals, again, regardless of race or gender, have not been given prison time. I would be shocked altogether, to be quite honest with you, if they did receive the death penalty. I don't see that happening in America in this day and time. However, my point is that law enforcement officers who have been involved in taking the lives of innocent American citizens do not at the bare minimum receive jail time. And that's, I guess, where my point is and where I was going to try to find out your idea or your thought on that.
Okay, Roger, thank you. So Todd, let me follow that up by asking then, are law enforcement being held accountable when they do wrong enough?
I could speak, you know, town of Greece where I was the chief of police. I can speak to the city of Rochester. I can speak to this community where I know things more often. You know the facts of cases. You know, speaking about what's occurring in Dallas, Texas, when you're getting a video and a snippet off the 6 o'clock news or you're getting some social media hits, I just think there's this awesome eye on the public. The public's watching us now. You know, body cameras and cell phones are showing as many pictures of incidents occurring. The public is definitely saying we need to help hold police accountable. If there's any time in my career of almost, you know, over 30 years in law enforcement that police officers are being watched and potentially held accountable for bad actions, it's now. I mean, it's at a scale that I've never seen before. With that, you know, go back to body cameras. I wish I would have had a body camera on for the last 30 years. You know, Todd Baxter made some mistakes. I'm human, right? I get upset. You know, we all make mistakes in our jobs. No one's perfect. But at the end of the day, I would love to have that body camera for the other 99 complaints that came against me for a discourtesy complaint or something. I would have loved to turn that video in and say, let's take a look at the video and have a quick review.
And Roger was keeping his questions not about race, not about gender, but there has been this occasional dissonance in this country regarding those situations. How do you feel about the Black Lives Matter movement?
You know, there's, again, Blue Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, all these they come with this vigor that comes behind them, and people get passionate about it, and then they start getting upset. You know, if you don't believe in my, that's not Todd Baxter. Todd Baxter is, I love people. I love all people. You know, and you almost don't want to say all lives matter because that comes with a negative connotation. But truly, deep down inside, that's what I believe in. You know, I love cops, and I hate to see a cop hurt. I hate when I see a 15, 16-year-old kid in Clinton Avenue with a bullet in his body. That hurts me, you know, as a person. I got empathy for everybody. And I think we can do better. And that's where I so crave this, if you will, this position of leadership that really break down a lot of that. I've been very successful in my career breaking down those stereotypes and breaking down those relationships. You know, there's a program at the YWCA called Person to Person. I was part of the inaugural class of that, where you sat down for six months with someone totally opposite you, and you developed a relationship with him. And that was when Ferguson was going on. And I had an African-American lady who was not happy about Ferguson. I would get text messages like, irate. We have a relationship now. You know, we don't agree on everything. We have a relationship. You could do so much more. And I think that power in that position of the sheriff could really help break down a lot of these stereotypes, build relationships. How about every one of those people we talked about incarcerated that are from a minority community that are sitting in a jail? What can we do better to build relationships with those folks while they're in our jail? Again, I'm not being soft on crime, right? But the fact is, we're all people at the end of the day. And what do we do to break down some of these stereotypes? Cops are all this and those people are all that. That's not true. You know, but we keep on doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
And I know you've said hire well, and you're going to have a great force of people, the vast majority who are out there for the right reasons. I think whether it's people like Roger or others who have had these kind of concerns, can you say to them unequivocally that if there is an officer under Todd Baxter in the Monroe County Sheriff's Department who does wrong and is demonstrated to have done wrong, they will be held accountable?
Absolutely. I've got a proven track record of that. Now, mistakes are made two ways, and kind of what we're talking about with the earlier gentleman. You know, they're intentional mistakes. They did it. They had a mindset, and they just went ahead and did it anyways. In my world, there's a different level of punishment. There's also mistakes of the heart. They're in the heat of the moment. They're making emotional decisions instead of professional decisions, and they just simply make a mistake there. They come in my office the next day, and they say, you know what? I screwed that one up. Well, here's your training. Here's your discipline. I've even terminated police officers, you know, and I don't take that lightly. I go home and I have a lot of sleepless nights. If I have to discipline a police officer to that level, I'm taking a career away from them. But I've done it. You're not going to tarnish the badge under Todd Baxter. There's too many of my good friends of mine that have bullet holes in their bodies that wear that blue uniform. No one can come in and intentionally tarnish the badge. But on the other side, a lot of these mistakes are emotional mistakes. I've made them. I've made mistakes as a law enforcement officer. You know, go forward to your internal affairs department and say, I screwed that one up. And the punishment's going to be a whole lot less. But there will be an adjustment. There will be an adjustment. How do you not adjust anybody in any organization, let alone one that has that much power as a law enforcement officer?
All right, let me get Sam in Rochester next up with Todd Baxter. Go ahead, Sam.
How you doing? My name is Reverend King. I know that I told you guys my name was Sam, but here's the problem. That I would
have. All right, Reverend.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so here's the problem that I would have with both of those gentlemen. I know both of them. And I have worked with both of them, O'Flynn and the gentleman you have in the office in the station today. And in working with the both of them, I've gotten good results from working side by side. Because the gentleman that you have today, we used to work in it. We used to go to the net office and have meetings. We used to have meetings with the PCIC.
Yes, sir.
Down on the west side, and so. I can say I've gotten a good response from the both of them. So you would have to look, I'd have to look very carefully at, both of them and then have to make a decision. I would hate to have to make a decision like this, you know, knowing both of them and have worked with both of them and gotten good results from working with them. So it would be hard for, it's going to be hard for me, but. It has to be done, you know. So,
well,
I just want to thank him, because we was in the service together about the same time in the Vietnam era, and I just want to thank him, for his service and my service in the Army together, and then coming out and continuing his service in the community with the Rochester Police Department for all those years. So, and then he steps up to the plate again and want to run for Monroe County Sheriff. I mean, his life is going to be a complete life of service. So, I mean,
thank you, Reverend. I appreciate that.
All right, Reverend, thank you for that. So he's saying it's going to be a hard choice for him. He likes both of you. So yeah. What do you want him to base the decision on?
Well, base it on the future. You know, the past is a great predictor of the future. We all realize that. But, you know, walk down Genesee Street, walk down Jefferson Avenue, go out to the four corners of Penfield, you know, walk the jail cells. What has changed? What has drastically changed in our community? We're spending a lot of money every year, and we're getting the same results. We're doing nice programs. You know, we've got Pat is a good – he's a good person, right? And he's responsive to the community, like the pastor said. But – do you want a whole lot more? You know, and that's me. Everywhere I've gone, I've challenged the status quo, and I've improved the organization drastically. And that's what I think. That's what motivates me. That's what got me and my family to make this decision. Could we do a whole lot more? And I'm talking about every – I worked in the town of Ogden. I worked in the town of Greece, so a large suburb. I worked in the city of Rochester. I know how to police across the spectrums, and I know how to, you know, bring services to those people across the spectrum of our whole community. That's what makes me different, that vision, that vigor, that drive, that what are we going to do next? What are we going to – how are we going to improve this? And I really bring the drive of the philosophy, again, take care of the deputies. Take care of the deputies. They'll take care of the constituents at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, they'll take care of the guy in the jail cell that's having a real tough time, having an emotional breakdown at 3 o'clock in the morning. They'll take care of them because we took care of them. We selected them well, we trained them well, and we hold them accountable, yet we praise them and motivate the heck out of them.
And yet you're online where?
Well, that's a great question.
You've got a website.
I do. BaxterForSheriff.com. BaxterForSheriff.com.
I didn't know if you knew it yet.
Yeah.
I knew it.
I forgot to mention it, so I was going to get yelled at if I didn't.
I will ask Patrick O'Flynn the same thing, yes, by the way. Todd Baxter is running for Monroe County Sheriff. Hopefully we'll see you alongside the sheriff in a different kind of conversations, debates, and more here. Come back sometime soon here.
Look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. That's Todd Baxter. BaxterForSheriff.com if you want to check out more on his candidacy there. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we're right back with you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.